Welcome back to Breast Cancer Update. I first met Craig Henderson at a coffee shop in Boston many years ago. Craig was then with Dana-Farber, and since that time, in his varied professional sojourns, we've continued to meet, usually about once a year, and touch base about what Craig calls his Talmudic interest in breast cancer clinical research. To begin our latest conversation, Dr. Henderson recounted a lecture he recently delivered.
Last Saturday was the CLGB's 50th anniversary, and I was asked to give a talk on the CLGB and endocrine therapy. Larry Norton gave one on CLGB and chemotherapy. I started my talk by saying that CLGB and endocrine therapy was an oxymoron, and described, particularly for those who are younger, the intense debate that took place in 1988 when we recognized that, in fact, the first presentations of the overview, not the first publication, but the first presentations, which were in 1984, 1985, had made a big mistake. One of the things that was exciting about the overview initially was that it showed both, the Europeans, of course, were excited, that tamoxifen reduced mortality, which I certainly hadn't anticipated. I just didn't think that enough cells would be affected and that it was cytostatic. But it also suggested that chemotherapy had a big impact on mortality, about the same degree impact on mortality of postmenopausal women. But when the dust settled, and before the first publication came out in the New England Journal in 89, it turned out that there were some errors in the actual calculations. Maybe this little fact of history has been lost along the way, and in fact that the effects of chemotherapy in postmenopausal women were not nearly as large. In fact, they were not statistically significant. And that was a bit of an embarrassment, and it forced us to rethink the issue, and we came back and the debate surrounded the fact that we needed to consider an amendment to our protocol at that time, which was the CAF dose study, in which we added tamoxifen to the regimen for all postmenopausal ER-positive women. And a lot of the medical oncologists were not willing to accept that. It just didn't make sense that this wimpy therapy could, in fact, have as great an impact as chemotherapy. It just was not the way we were used to thinking. I think it's taken a long time for this to sink in. Now, I think that the outgrowth of this, of course, is that Herceptin is a growth factor regulator, the same way endocrine therapy is. Herceptin is also a bit of a wimpy therapy. I mean, it has almost no toxicity. It was amazing at the beginning, and I really didn't think it would have such a big impact, even though Larry Norton and I were the first two investigators to do a phase two study on it and see these responses, which are really quite dramatic. So I think that it has required an acceptance, first, of the fact that there really are two very, very powerful therapies, that is the cytotoxics in one group and endocrine therapy and Herceptin in another group, that both of these, given in the right population, in fact, work very, very well. And with that acceptance, then we're willing to accept that there are specific markers that pick out the patients that will benefit these two therapies. In general, prognostic factors and predictive factors only become valuable as you have therapies to go with them. You can't separate these two things. And you can see in the history of medicine that, for example, we really didn't give up the mastectomy until we had lumpectomy and radiation. A therapy was really just as radical. But until there was an alternative, we couldn't give up the radical mastectomy. You can find many other examples where changes take place only as there is really a new therapy and the underlying science may go ahead of this area of the therapeutics for a while, and our understandings may go ahead, but we don't really accept it. We don't really change until we have therapeutic alternatives to employ. And I think that's what's driving this process right now. Now, when you ask about Topo 2, I think clearly you're on the edge of something that's very new. I think scientifically it makes good sense. I don't think we're there yet to use that as a way of making our choices because we haven't yet enough data to show that this will actually make a difference in outcome. It's sort of like the Oncotype DX. It's the same thing. It makes sense, and I assume that most people are beginning to use it on some patients, but very few people are using it on all patients. And on the other hand, I believe that ER and HER2 are now being used on almost all patients because there's a very clear relationship between the specific therapy in each case and the prognostic/predictive factor.
I want to pick up on a couple of these issues, both ER as well as TOPA2, and whether or not, you know, just to elaborate a little bit more about how you think ER can be used clinically or might be used clinically in decisions about chemotherapy. I guess we really haven't had very good predictors of response to chemotherapy. And topo II, in terms of anthracyclines, is sort of out on the table. There were a couple papers presented at ASCO looking at topo II. What's your take right now on sort of what the data show at this point and where you think it's heading?
I think on topo II, the evidence is pretty clear that, A, it scientifically makes sense. It's something that we began talking about more than a decade ago. It was particularly interesting because topo II is on the same chromosome as HER2. And remember the early papers when we thought there was a correlation between the use of doxorubicin and HER2? I don't think that's really held up. Certainly you saw this year that when Danny Hayes presented the data from 9344, we didn't see a correlation between HER2 expression and doxorubicin dose. And we predicted in the earlier study we had conducted, this was the CAF dose study that CLGB conducted in the mid-80s, that HER2 predicted for the patients who are going to get a benefit from the higher CAF dose.
On the other hand, you know, Kathy Pritchard published a paper in the New England Journal this spring looking at HER2 and the CEF versus CMF. And, I mean, my read on that was it was correlated with benefit from anthracyclines.
Again, you're using three drugs, and it's hard to separate out that it's very specific for the anthracyclines. In the case of the study where I think people listening to these things must get confused by all the numbers. You know, the groupies using all the numbers, but the protocol 9344, which is the first study in which we looked at four cycles of CA and then randomized to Taxol or no Taxol. It's sometimes forgotten that that study was designed initially to look at the dose of adriamycin. And that was the only thing we changed. So in the first four cycles, patients got one of three different doses of adriamycin, but we did not change the dose of cyclophosphamide. Remember, the NSABP had previously done studies where they changed the dose of cyclophosphamide, but not the dose of adriamycin. And so that became kind of a neat, clean test of the issue of adriamycin. So, yes, Kathy Pritchard got the same results with CEF as we'd earlier gotten with CAF, and those studies did match. But in both those cases, we were not looking at the anthracycline quite specifically. And when we looked at the anthracycline very specifically, we only changed the adriamycin dose and not the cyclophosphamide dose. We got no evidence of benefit from escalating the dose from 60 to 75 to 90 per meter squared. And then this year at ASCO, Dan Hayes showed that if you looked at the HER2 positive and the HER2 negatives independently, there was no difference. In other words, there was no greater benefit for escalating adria dose in those patients that overexpressed HER2 than in those patients that did not overexpress HER2. So HER2 was not predictive. But that earlier group of studies, we thought it was predictive, specifically for anthracyclines. And we hypothesized that was probably true because the overexpression HER2 was probably associated with the overexpression of TOPO2 because they're located very close together on the chromosome.
If the TOPO2 assay were available to a clinician or if for some reason a patient had a TOPO2 assay, do you think it would be reasonable to consider that in deciding, A, whether or not to use an anthracycline or not in a patient who is HER2 negative, or B, whether or not to use an anthracycline in someone who is HER2 positive?
I think that the anthracyclines are so powerful and so valuable for the treatment of breast cancer that I would be very hesitant to leave out adriamycin until the data were very compelling that there was a group that received no benefit. It's sort of the same as the way we function as physicians with ER. We know that patients who are ER positive derive less benefit from chemotherapy than those who are ER negative. But it's not an all or none phenomenon. And there's still room for clinical judgment. Where do you draw the line? And we know that patients will undergo the inconvenience of chemotherapy even when they have a fairly good prognosis, even when the benefit is fairly marginal. So I think the same thing applies here. When are you comfortable enough to say that I'm going to leave out what is still really the single most powerful drug? As good as the taxanes are, and I'm very enthusiastic about the taxanes, I don't believe that they are any better than, and maybe they're not quite as good as, the anthracyclines in the treatment of breast cancer.
What are your thoughts about nab-paclitaxel, Abraxane?
I'm very enthusiastic about Abraxane. I have a bit of a bias here in that, you know, I was very involved in the development of Doxil. And with Doxil and with Abraxane, you have a delivery system in which you, by a couple of mechanisms in the case of Abraxane, and certainly by at least one mechanism in the case of Doxil, increase the amount of drug that actually gets to the tumor. The issue of dose has been a complicated thing in cancer, because when we look at it in animal models, there clearly is a dose effect. We look at it in leukemia, there's clearly an advantage for higher dose. Almost every oncologist has been taught as part of their earliest training that dose is a critical factor. But when we in fact do most dose studies, it's hard to show that dose makes a lot of difference. And I think the high-dose chemotherapy in bone marrow transplant is a case in point. I think that the reason why we've not been able to show that dose is so important is because we're looking at the amount of dose we give to the patient rather than the amount of dose that actually gets to the tumor. And what happens with a delivery system is you change the distribution of drug so that less goes to the normal tissue and a higher dose goes to the tumor itself. And that's what happens with Doxil, and that's what happens with Abraxane. And in both cases, you can show that very, very elegantly in preclinical models. Showing that in the human, of course, is more difficult because it's not so easy to biopsy tumor and actually measure the drug level in the tumor. But I think that's what's happening with Abraxane. We know that we can actually give higher doses. If we go back to the old study of Taxol, the dose study, Eric Weiner was the lead investigator on that study, and we looked at 175, 225, and 250 per meter squared of Taxol in patients with metastatic breast cancer. We failed to show a significant or a dramatic effect from escalating Taxol dose. But in fact, there is some marginal effect there from the higher doses and a suggestion that you get a longer time to tumor progression. And in fact, that in some of the analyses reached statistical significance as an endpoint. And so I think what you're seeing with Abraxane is that you can, in fact, give higher doses. Patients tolerate higher doses. In the preclinical models, the mice tolerate higher doses of Abraxane than they do of Taxol delivered in Cremafor, or paclitaxel delivered in Cremafor, which is what Taxol is. And that in addition to that, not only do they tolerate higher doses, but because of the way the albumin interacts with the paclitaxel, you deliver higher doses to the tumor. And so that's why I think they were able to show a significantly better outcome with Abraxane. So I think this is a very interesting step forward.
I thought it was interesting when you were talking about nab-paclitaxel and Doxil, that you focus on the hopefully improved efficacy or delivery to the tumor, and yet clinicians look at them for the advantages in terms of side effects and toxicity. You know, we're talking about nab-paclitaxel, people look at the lack of need for pre-medication and the shorter infusion time. What are your thoughts about that in terms of the clinical benefits of the two drugs?
Well, I think that anybody looking at a delivery system has to recognize that the way to get things going, the way to get enthusiasm is oftentimes the demonstration of less toxicity, because it's in fact much easier to demonstrate decreased toxicity. It's more readily apparent than it is to demonstrate increased efficacy. It takes larger trials. Oftentimes the increases in efficacy are marginal. So for example, these trials that we've just been talking about with bevacizumab even, we're talking about fairly large studies compared to what we did a generation ago. even the study with nab-paclitaxel, it's amazing. That's a very small study. I think they were lucky to get the result that they did. So efficacy is a hard thing to show, and it's a hard thing to evaluate in an individual patient. Toxicity is immediately apparent and therefore impacts our decision-making right away.
What are your thoughts about SPARC that may be CART-related to the way nab-paclitaxel work?
Well, I think SPARC is a very interesting observation. The important thing here is that the albumin appears to bind to SPARC, and SPARC is overexpressed in a number of different tumors.
It's a protein?
And it's a protein, and it's been described, I think the first descriptions are now maybe 10 to 15 years old. There's been a lot of preclinical work on this. It has been associated with increased expression in a number of tumor types. And so it's a story that makes sense. I would say probably the final proof of principle isn't there. You remember that also there appear to be specific transport systems in the vasculature for albumin, and that therefore not only are you dealing with a larger particle when you look at nab-paclitaxel, and a larger particle then can go through the gaps that occur in tumor tissue because the vasculature in tumor tissues is leaky. Makes sense. These are new vessels being made. They're being made very rapidly.
Aberrantly in many cases.
And it's not very good construction.
Right.
You know, these are sort of shanty towns, so to speak, that are built at a construction site where the tumors are growing very rapidly. And therefore, anything that's large can pass through those blood vessels and through the gaps that normally occur in the vasculature, while the junctions in between cells, blood vessel cells, in normal tissues are tighter and won't allow these big particles to go through. So that's why a liposome and why a nab-paclitaxel will actually go through these leaky vessels. So that's number one reason why you would get a higher level of paclitaxel in the nab-paclitaxel. Then number two is you have the binding to the albumin-binding sites in the vessels. So that helps take a larger amount of the paclitaxel-bound albumin into the tumor. And then thirdly, you have the binding to SPARC, the attraction to the tumor itself. So all three of these seem to be reasons why you get a better response to nab-paclitaxel than you do to cremaphore-paclitaxel.
Is it possible to do an assay of SPARC, IHC or whatever, and could that theoretically be used to select therapies?
Theoretically, I think it could.
You were mentioning about the issue of the vasculature and it continued to divert out a little bit. I'm curious about your thoughts about the data on bevacizumab, first in colon cancer, then in breast and lung cancer, and particularly the debate about why it's working and whether it's delivering chemotherapy more effectively to tumor cells. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it is sort of an irony because intuitively you would think that bevacizumab would have exactly the opposite effect. In other words, we've always known that one of the problems with delivering chemotherapy to the inside of the tumor is that it's necrosis. It doesn't have a good vascular system. You don't get very much oxygen in there. Therefore, radiotherapy isn't as effective. You don't get very much drug in there, for the drug is less ineffective on this dying inner part of the tumor. So you would think when you then took an anti-angiogenesis agent and you killed these blood vessels that you'd have the same kind of thing. And therefore, it would be antagonistic rather than synergistic. I find the fact that we're seeing these effects of increased activity of chemotherapy and bevacizumab now in not only colon cancer, but breast cancer, where I find the data very compelling, lung cancer, renal cancer, which we know is a very angiogenic tumor, that in all of these cases where we've used them together, there appears to be really good evidence of synergy. That you have to now go from the clinic back to the laboratory and say, it's not working the way you would have hypothesized. Now, the preclinical data obviously suggest that what seems to be happening, what intuitively makes sense to me in looking at the preclinical experiments, is that somehow in the face of bevacizumab, there is less chaos. In other words, the vasculature is less chaotic, is more effective, and therefore you're delivering more drug. I suppose it's one of those things where we'll continue to have greater insight over the next 20 years. You know, we never understand the mechanism of most of our drugs. We start out with one idea and we keep changing it every several years.
It's interesting you referred to the bevacizumab first-line data, the ECOG 2100 data, as compelling, because it's actually been kind of interesting. It's been a little controversial. Of course, we're waiting to see if there's going to be FDA approval, reimbursement, their cost issues, all these other things. But then there's also putting that aside and looking at the clinical science of what happened in that trial, what happened in the prior capecitabine trial. Some people kind of seem like they're not that impressed with the E2100, and there are a lot of other people like you who are. What is it about that impresses you?
Well, I suppose I'm like anybody else. When I see a p-value of 0.001, I see effects that are fairly large. We forget easily how many negative trials we conduct and how much of our science is based on marginal significance. So when you get what appears to be a very robust outcome, and further, when you see this pattern, as I've mentioned already, in multiple tumor types, so that you have a scientific hypothesis that's compelling, you have something that seems to be repeated. Interestingly, in all situations, you do seem to get a greater effect from using bevacizumab early rather than late. That seems to be a relatively consistent pattern. I wouldn't say we've got it nailed down. We don't have that many studies, but we're talking about, around 9-10 randomized trials now? Yeah, if you take colon, lung, breast, and renal, and there are 1 to 2 in each one of those, so that makes at least 6 to 8. I think there are even some additional small ones, so
yeah,
we're
colon,
somewhere around 8 randomized trials. And this pattern seems to be somewhat consistent. I find that together compelling. Yes, I would say the answer isn't in yet. It's a little disturbing that it wasn't quite as significant when presented the second time. This is now the paclitaxel study. That it wasn't quite as compelling the second time as it was the first time in terms of survival. I think when we're talking about marginal p-values, that you expect them to fluctuate somewhat.
I think some of this is psychological. I don't know. You know, I don't know if you would agree with this. Kathy Miller and George Lege both will say the improvement that was seen by adding bevacizumab to a taxane, in this case paclitaxel, was greater than would have been seen with prior trials adding in a second form of chemotherapy like an anthracycline, and with relatively modest toxicity compared to using combination chemotherapy. And I think it's just hard for clinicians to look at data and try to put it in perspective and what it means. Those two, of course, are saying, you know, this is a good risk-benefit, putting aside the cost issues. This is a good risk-benefit buy for patients based on their data. Do you agree with that?
By and large, I do agree with it. I am a little concerned in that, and I think a lot of docs probably are, you know, medical oncologists are really very, very comfortable when we're dealing with myelosuppression. GI toxicity is a little harder for us to deal with because the patients feel it a lot.
And now we're becoming dermatologists.
That's right, with the hand-foot syndrome.
And also the EGFR and, you know, tons
well, that's right.
There, lots
we have,
of rashes
there,
out
we have
there.
All those rashes, yes.
Yeah.
Although those never seem quite as serious as the hand-foot syndrome. But yes, you're right. But I don't think we're nearly as comfortable even with those things as we are with the very serious and potentially life-threatening issues of myelosuppression and even thrombocytopenia, because we've learned to live with that and we're very comfortable. When we move into these new areas, and I was thinking specifically of the issues of bleeding and hypertension with bevacizumab, they do make us worried. And I think that probably in the case of Kathy and George, since they've been actually doing the studies, they're probably a little ahead of the rest of us. They probably have a comfort level with some of those side effects that I haven't reached yet. It bothers me a little bit. And it also bothers me that the data are compelling enough that I think we're tempted to just add Avastin to everything, kind of all tumor therapy. And maybe that's going a little too fast. So on the one hand, it's promising we should be using it, but I'm still a little worried.
Well, you know, it's interesting because if you look at the average oncologist in practice who's treating lots of colon cancer, we know from our patterns of care studies that bevacizumab is standard care, first-line therapy, you know, usually with an oxaliplatin regimen, so they're used to it. The breast cancer investigators who don't see colon cancer actually are the ones, I think, that are not. And it's interesting that right now there is a lot of confusion, hesitation. I think if the drug were reimbursed tomorrow, I'm still not sure investigators would use it as much or OCS in practice. And yet I look at the numbers and the risk-benefit ratio, and it looks positive.
That's been my interpretation too. So we don't have any disagreement on that. I've been very impressed. And again, it's these stories, you look at the first thing that comes out. So I go back always in my own experience, the Herceptin study, 5 patients out of 43, Genentech was going to drop it. The Journal of Positive Results refused to publish it and said that this wasn't important.
5 out of 43 responses?
5 out of 43, the first study.
To monotherapy?
To monotherapy.
Interesting.
And as I said, the Journal of Positive Results turned it down.
That's New England Journal?
Yeah. And then look at Herceptin. And boy, it was hard to believe that that was going to happen. Well, I still remember going to hear the first bevacizumab presentation by George Sled at ASCO. I forgot how many patients now. Somehow 17.6 in my mind, but it was maybe larger than that. Thinking, well, this isn't going to go anywhere. I saw the hypertension. There wasn't much bleeding, actually, much as they expected, but it still didn't impress me much. Then the capecitabine study came out. I thought, well, that's what I thought. Then the taxane study came out, and, you know, I've always been evidence-based, and it's very impressive. I just think it'll take a while to get people on board. I think it's going to happen. You know, the breast cancer docs have so many drugs in their armamentarium. I've been sort of chiding them lately, saying, you know, what have you guys developed since Herceptin? What's happening now is even the new chemotherapies, they used to be first in breast cancer. Now they're coming in lung cancer, colon cancer, so on. You have so many things. I was talking to a young investigator at a major cancer center recently about testing a new drug that I'm interested in. And he said, well, if we don't get responses right away, he said, we go on to the next thing because we have so many things to test. Well, if we'd done that with Herceptin, there wouldn't be any Herceptin today. And in fact, that would have had a big negative impact on the whole biotech industry. So I think it's too bad because a lot of the most interesting and promising things in cancer that are coming up one after another have very humble beginnings. That's been true of the EGFR inhibitors. Every one of them looked kind of dull. Each has proven to be an important drug. That was true of Herceptin. That's true of Avastin. Over and over again, it's almost to the point where if it looks really good at the beginning, it may have a marginal benefit. It's the ones with the weak signals but have an interesting mechanism that's distinctly different that eventually seem to be coming to the fore, but it just takes a long time and a lot of patience.
I'm curious about your current thoughts on the CALGB 9741 dose-dense trial, both in terms of the recent discussions about the impact in ER-positive versus ER-negative patients, and also in terms of what you think is going on in terms of why we saw this advantage. Do you think it's based on the Norton-Simon hypothesis or scheduling of the taxanes, et cetera?
A couple things. First of all, the issue of ER-positive, ER-negative doesn't bother me very much because I've been convinced for quite a few years that the effects of chemotherapy are much larger than we thought years ago. It was interesting because you asked a question on your questionnaire about a 77-year-old woman who's ER-negative and 3-plus nodes. Well, if you'd given me that questionnaire 10 years ago, I wouldn't have considered treating that patient with chemotherapy at all. Today, I would give that patient dose-dense therapy without thinking twice because I think that the effects are much larger in that ER-negative patient, even though she's 77, than I had anticipated, let's say, in 1985. So this whole business of ER-negative, ER-positive, I think it applies across the board. It doesn't make a difference what chemotherapy you're talking about. I don't think it has anything to do with the taxanes. Okay, so leaving that aside, so where you're really looking at the effects of chemotherapy are in the ER-negative patients. I think that evidence, though, overall, and therefore and the general principle is well established, is that the dose-dense regimen is significantly better than the non-dose-dense regimen. Now, again, you ask the question, does that have anything to do with the taxanes? I suspect not. You know, when this paper was presented, it was presented, if you recall, at San Antonio for the first time, not at ASCO. And I hadn't read the discussant. And I pulled out the slides from the original Cooper regimen. And you remember that in the Cooper regimen, cyclophosphamide was given daily for years. And you don't get anything more dose-dense than that. And in fact, giving daily cyclophosphamide at the kinds of doses that Cooper did is not very pleasant. You know, patients in the old days used to tolerate giving cycloadrea every 3 weeks. And these are the pre-Zofran days when you sometimes had to hospitalize them with intravenous fluid because they had so much nausea and vomiting. But it was over 3 or 4 days. And then they would be okay for the rest of the cycle. While with CMF, you got a little bit of nausea here and there every day. Patients didn't tolerate it as well as they tolerated the concentrated nausea vomiting every 3 weeks. And so this idea of giving cyclophosphamide every day was not very attractive, and it's why it dropped out so quickly. We've done randomized trials showing that conventional CMF, where you give cyclophosphamide every day, is superior to IV CMF, and yet IV CMF is very popular. In fact, that's always one of the things that's puzzled me. I think it's because the comparison, the randomized trial, comparing those two is a European trial. So I find a dose-dense 9741 study totally consistent with some of the things that have gone before, even the earliest work in the field of medical oncology. You have a tumor sitting there that has a relatively low growth fraction. And it is when the tumor cell decides that it's going to divide that it's vulnerable. If you treat with cytotoxic therapies and the tumor cell doesn't try to divide and it sits there for 3 or 4 days or sits there for 3 or 4 weeks before it, you know, decides to move, it has plenty of time to repair the damage that the alkylating agent and other cytotoxics have inflicted, and therefore it doesn't die. So the proximity of the therapy to cancer cells that decide to divide is, I think, a critical factor. And that's why, personally, I believe that dose-dense has been very effective. And in fact, I think this is an observation that some of us made several decades ago when we were trying to puzzle through why the Cooper regimen was so effective.
You know, it's interesting. There's a trial now in node-negative patients looking at dose-dense AC without a taxane and dose-dense taxane without AC. And a lot of people who've used dose-dense AC paclitaxel, who've seen patients sort of cruise through the AC part a little bit easier, are actually utilizing that strategy of dose-dense AC off-study. What are your thoughts about that?
I see that happening even in my own clinic. Started a couple patients in the last few weeks on dose-dense adjuvant chemotherapy, and in discussing it with some of my colleagues, I find that, in fact, they're doing this. This is in a university setting. So it's happening in part because of the issues related to GCSF and reimbursement. There's practicality there because the patients have to pay a very high price. And so docs are saying, well, I want to make sure that it's worth it, and maybe I don't have to give, and the patient doesn't have to pay such a high price, oftentimes some of it out of their own pocket, or making a lot more extra visits to the clinic and so on, if they don't get the taxane in a dose-dense fashion. We'll have to wait and see what the science is. You noticed a while ago I was talking about the fact that it was the alkylating agents in the early studies that were critical. That may be the case now. We can't separate 9741, which is the critical factor, that is the CA or the taxane. So I think we'll have to wait. But you do know that the data suggests that weekly paclitaxel is better than every 3 weekly. Again, that's a study that some people have criticized for good reason.